The interesting thing on the PEST models is that Purdue, in fact, many, many years ago, developed one of the first PEST models, the alfalfa PEST model, which was developed by Don Holt, written up in Science magazine. So the models are there, and it would not be too much to do. Okay, I'm going to go into a couple of the tools. Fortunately, Hans has gone into them enough so that I can go even faster through this and go into this. You have to go back a little bit and think of what we were doing originally in terms of how the whole project was put together, in terms that it allowed for a number of different pieces, including extending the sort of obvious climate crop model kinds of things into what I'll call not just economics, but management as well for doing this. The fact that we have this data set that our previous speaker talked about allows us to do a lot of stuff. The fact that we can do the site level gridded crop modeling allows us to do the economic modeling with a better feeling that we might be somewhere on target. This original thing that several people have shown in terms of, in essence, an underutilization of past and future weather data becomes an important parameter in terms of thinking about how you might help people with the economics of some of this. My favorite on a lot of these sorts of things is Australia's CSIRO program in this area, their yield profit. I don't know if any of you were able to hear Mark Howden this morning, who spoke, who's visiting here today, who led this effort in Australia. Long history and good data on climate, data rich, probability based, and I'll keep coming back to that, and a great deal of model depth. If you Google yield profit, you get to things like this, okay, that will get you into yield profit. And on the right there is what I think is the critical thing for us now, thinking about farmer decisions, particularly with respect to what is tactical and what is strategic. On the right, the little probability graph under different conditions, you're going to face different probabilities of different outcomes. Again, this describes it a little bit. Farmers in Australia pay for it, and they pay a substantial amount. Their field data, their soil data, their climate data, everything is loaded in for their farm. And they then go from there with the yield models. I think the factors for success in Australia, one of them is the high variability of rainfall and yields, which makes, in essence, these models, gives them an opportunity to be economically terribly important. The extensive agriculture in comparison to intensive production also sort of adds to that same flavor in terms of making this much more economically important. Farmers in Australia who use this are not just in Lake Wobegon, but their profits average 10 to 15% more than other farmers around them. They're in the 60th percentile of profits on a regular basis. CSIRO as an institution for years really led the climate field. Their ability to do this has been slammed by the last government in Australia, but they still have an incredible human resource and institutional resource to do this. Okay, there are tools. You've seen that. Growing degree days, you've seen. Let me just add a little bit here on this. I'm going to go back one. Recognize that for all these tools, you pick your place. And then all this data that's been collected there gets loaded in for that place. And so you can pick your place across the 12-state area, and you have immediately zeroed in on your place. That is an incredible advantage and really something we now take for granted after a couple of years, but that's really neat. The tool itself And if we particularly go to some of the highlighted areas in the whole business of silking and black layer, and for example, I've just seen some back and forth, some people using the growing degree tool and trying to adapt it to forage production, and when during the season should they harvest their forage for the highest nutrient content. This sort of thing can do this. We first built a growing degree day tool at Purdue in the 1970s when there was a shortage of propane gas for grain drying. And what we were doing for about 4 or 5 years, the state used this tool to try to figure out, given a certain planting date, given growing degree days on average weather plus accumulated weather, what was the moisture of corn going to be at harvest and how much gas for drying would be needed in the state? And that was an original use on this that was critically important. The spring freeze one is terribly important. If you are talking about adaptation to climate change and you're talking about moving to, let's say, a shorter term variety to try to miss the heat period for pollination, and you want to push back as much as possible to try to get your crop in as early as possible, this is a tool you can begin to use on a probability basis in terms of what risk do you take at what early planting date. And that becomes terribly important. The corn split N, we've been through some of this. Again, you can pick your spot in terms of where you're going to do it. You put in all these various things that you load in. This is data rich in terms of the kinds of things you have to put in terms of when you might apply nitrogen. We're looking at yield penalties for not getting the nitrogen in. If you're trying to side dress, you all of a sudden hit unusually wet weather and you can't get in the field, what is your penalty? Your prices for everything there. The whole description of your implements, how fast can you do it? Okay, field work days become absolutely critical important during these periods that you might want to do it. The field work day tool is incredible in this, and one of the things we face on this with field work days is that historically in recent years, we're in some areas seeing a few less field work days because of more rainfall at times that would have been clear historically. Economic analysis, I'll just run through all the stuff. This basically says if you tried this side dressing for a proportion of your crop, that given that you can apply less nitrogen, given that you are putting it down when the plant needs it or closer to when it needs it, you might gain as much as $36,000, okay, in terms of being able to do that. However, worst case scenario, you are rained out, you can't get into the field, and you lose $91,000. This is a game of trade-offs and roulette. And I think I'll come back to this in a little while. I think it's terribly important to present it in this way, and particularly as we'll get through these things you put in, particularly this graphic of the probability of completing your application. Because in essence, you follow that probability curve, and then you can then make a decision as to how much risk you want to take. All right, and this has some very important characteristics. Fairly soon, we're going to be rolling out an irrigation investment calculator, which takes into account cost, probabilities of different weather, yields associated with dry, average, and wet years. This becomes tremendously important, and we know that with the high commodity prices we had a couple years ago, a large number of people in the upper Midwest, in the Plain States, really bought a lot more irrigation equipment. This is something that would help you making that irrigation equipment decision in terms of as you watch your weather and if you have the ability to put in changing or future weather patterns, is this something that's going to pay for you? Now, this is the stuff that I think is really important. I would argue with you that today farmers operate on a management basis on what I would call recipe farming. They have a variety that their seed salesman tells them is the right variety. Monsanto or someone else tells them their program in terms of weed control. They have a program in terms of fertilizer applications. And if you do the recipe, you'll come out fairly well on a fairly continuous basis with relatively low risk. I would argue with you that if we begin to see a trend of some of the extreme events and other things we're already seeing in climate change, that we will have to move away from recipe farming. A discussion this morning from Mark Howden, who was saying, you know, what we're seeing is farmers are making individual little tactical decisions to adjust to things they see. But the question is, are they going to approach this differently from a broader strategic perspective? And I would argue that if we can get farmers thinking about climate change as something different from their recipe farming, that this is the critical thing to do, to get them thinking in terms of probabilities and that they're going to have to make judgments on these probabilities. There's not going to be a given number for them, that outcomes will vary beyond their control, that resilience may become more important, something we really haven't needed to talk about, and that we may have to become much more diversified in terms of practices, genetics, and cropping systems, and we will have to look at this as a system and use a systems approach to go ahead and do this. Just mentioned earlier, tremendous change over the last 5 years. Monsanto's purchasing Climate Corp for $1 billion. Things like Pioneers and Circa, Nitrogen Management Service. One of the things that is difficult here is, again, mentioned already, the business that these are closed tools with very specific outputs that tend to be more recipe outputs because this is what the farmer is used to. They're given specific numbers. I think this is wrong educationally. I think it's terribly important that we start educating farmers that we can't do this. The example on this is the Pioneer in Circa claims at various times to be able to tell the farmer exactly how much available reactive nitrogen is in his field at the moment to the pound. And we get to the thing of precision versus accuracy. Is it accurate, number one, but how in God's name could you ever be that precise? We really don't have the ability to do that. There are going to be some real trade-offs, public and private, with data. One of the things that Pioneer is pushing is that they will sign up a whole mess of farmers in your area. The data will be anonymous, but they will be able to help you tune your farm with the data from your neighboring farms, okay, which would be an advantage, no question about it. Whether they will be able to do this or not, I don't know. But I think we're in a different ball game. I'm very concerned that we start getting farmers to think about their production process in a different sort of way from the recipe farming we've been doing for the last, really, 30 years. Thank you. If I haven't gored someone's ox, I'll be unhappy. Yeah. The answer is I don't know, but as an economist, I never say that. I say it depends. I think one thing is that we have to design our tools so that they are probability tools. And we've been able to do that in U2U, and I think that's really important. And the Australians did that right from the get-go, that we're not going to be able to give you exact numbers. You're going to have to look at what the probabilities are. The other thing I think we can do, and I think some of the climate forcings or things we may be seeing in terms of extreme events may allow us also to start talking to farmers in climate terms about resilience and in terms how you may want to handle your genetic choice a little bit and take a little bit of yield loss to get a certain kind of resilience, be it to drought, be it to planting date with maybe a slightly shorter term variety. When I started in this business, there was a tremendous yield penalty as you move from long-term to short-term varieties. That almost doesn't exist anymore in practical terms. They've narrowed that down so much. So farmers really have, in a sense, a lot more flexibility in some of these areas than I think they do. And I think we need to start talking with them about, hey, you're going to have to think a little bit more about some increased probability for some of those worst cases, the losing $91,000 rather than making $36,000, and how are you going to adjust for that? So I think there's some things we can do there to move them into a somewhat different mindset. Yeah.
How much do you think crop insurance has impacted that?
Oh, gosh. Crop insurance does impact it. We have people who farm the program rather than the land. I've been through some famous ones starting in the 1980s when the first disaster program came, spearheaded by Senator Hubert Humphrey from this great state of Minnesota. We thought in the 5 years of the Farm Bill it would cost $380 million, and in the first year we spent $350 million. And what happened was speculators bought land in places like southwestern Colorado. They got one crop of wheat to grow on it at some point and then sold it as cropland. And the farmer could sign up for the disaster payments, the crop insurance, and everything else, and farm the program. With increased weather variability, crop insurance helps farmers to deal with that and to continue recipe farming to some extent. So it's definitely a factor.